I know it's hard. I'm good with it, though. I'm just kidding. I'm going to miss you guys a lot, and I hope that Yemirta Hashem, next year there will probably be the same chug again, I'm guessing, but I am hoping to add additional chugim, perhaps additional Shana Aleph chugim, and also Shana Bet chug. So for those of you who will be back next year, I look forward to learning with you again, and for those of you who will be in other places, hopefully you can catch us on the web, and hopefully be able to follow the many shurim, not only from this year, but also all the other shurim that are online. As it happens, I think this is a good week and a good topic to end on. In honor of Shavuos this coming week, I wanted to speak about a topic that is kind of indirectly related, but I think very, very connected, and that is the topic of Elu Ve'elo Divrei Elokim Chayim. Traditionally, certainly from the time of Chazal, we have associated the holiday of Shavuos with Zman Matan Torah Seinu. We celebrate, even if we're not exactly sure if it's the perfect anniversary, but we do celebrate Matan Torah. That is certainly the main theme of our celebration of Shavuos nowadays. And when you think about Matan Torah, which obviously was a life-changing event for the Jewish people, completely defines us in a way that almost nothing else single-handedly does the way Matan Torah does. So a lot of different factors and obvious questions come up. But one of them, the one that I'd like to talk with you about this evening, has to do with the multiplicity of opinions. Obviously, we have spent most of our day, most of this year, learning Gemara. And obviously, you can't go, a few lines of Gemara without a machlokas. And on each of those individual opinions, we have multiple machlokas in the Rishonim. And on the various opinions, the Rambam or others, we have multiple opinions in the Achronim and in the Poskim. And obviously, you have this tremendous variety of opinion. And the question is how to understand it all. Hashem gave us the Torah, well, which one did he give us? Did he say we should light the Hanukkah candles, 1 to 8 or 8 to 1? I mean, exactly how should we do it? And, all the different questions that you can come up with in everyday life. You should put on Rashi tefillin or you should put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. You have to wait 72 minutes till Shabbos is over, or 50 minutes is enough. I mean, there's endless questions. You do have to put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed, you don't have to put on tefillin on Chol HaMoed. You should shave during Sfira, you shouldn't shave during Sfira. I mean, there's so many questions. Obviously, I threw in some Darabanans there too. But I think the principle, even though different, is basically the same. And again, our question, obviously, going back to Matan Torah, is how do we understand the concept of this? Now, I'm not going to be discussing this from a historical perspective, even though the Rishonim and Achronim speak about the quote evolution of machlokes. That's not our topic, but I want to speak about this topic to the extent that the Gemara itself addresses this from the perspective, you could say, either of metaphysics or theology. I'm not sure what the exact right word would be, but really with the focus or the aim on truth. If we understand that Matan Torah and the giving of the Torah is the way Hashem revealed his ultimate moral truth to us, so then how do we make sense of contradictory and conflicting opinions? Now that would be, in the abstract, a very reasonable question, I think. The question takes on much more urgency and becomes much more fascinating when you see how Chazal themselves addressed it. And even though I think ultimately we'll get some possible perspectives on this, the initial Gemara's attitude towards this actually doesn't solve any problems, but in fact, in a very tantalizing way, seems to deepen and make the question even more profound. I'm referring to two Gemaras, one more famous than the other, but we'll try to mention them both. The first, the more famous Gemara, is the Gemara in Erevin, on Daf Yud Gimel Amud Bet. The Gemara here tells us, Gimel Shanim Nechleku Beis Shammayim Beis Hillel. We know that there's so many scattered particular machlokos between Beis Shammayim Beis Hillel, and how do we paskin like him, like them? Which one? The Gemara says it's a battle royal, cage match between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel for 3 years with no resolution. Halolo Omrim, Halacha Kamotenu, Halolo Omrim, Halacha Kamotenu. Right, they're arguing why, Beis Shammai is arguing why they're right, Beis Hillel is arguing why they're right. And finally, after a 3-year stalemate, says the Gemara, Yatza Baskol V'amra, Eilu Ve'elo Divrei Elokim Chayim Hein, V'Halacha K'Beis Hillel. There's a lot to unpack in that one sentence. All right, so first let's translate the words, and then we'll try to get to the details. First of all, says the Gemara, a heavenly voice came out, a baskol, and pronounced these and those, Elu v'Elu, they're both true, they're both Divrei Elokim Chayim, they're both from Hashem. Right, Hashem, the Gemara tells us, is Chosam Emes, God is the definition of truth. His essence is truth. And these words are both expressions of the living God. So it seems to be, in essence, they're both true. That itself seems to be a problem. But, by the way, even though they're both true, halacha is like Beis Hillel. So, we're going to focus mainly on the middle part, a little bit on the last part, and not at all on the first. Namely, the first thing in this, which is really, you know, its own topic, is the Baskol. First of all, what is a Baskol? That's one question. Secondly, whatever a Baskol is, it certainly seems to be a divine intervention, obviously. And that seems to go against a different rule which we have in Halacha, what also could have been a very appropriate Shavuos themed topic, Loba Shamayimi. So here we are paskining tens, hundreds, I don't even know exactly how many different machlokuses. We're paskining them based on what? A Baskol. How is that possible? What does that mean? Interesting and not our topic. The last part of the statement, which we'll just mention now just for a moment, is the fact that despite the fact that Eil Elokim Chayim, the halacha is like Beis Hillel. Well, why should it be like Beis Hillel if Divrei Elokim Chayim? So here the Gemara continues and says something very fascinating. Again, this is still not the main thing we're going to focus on, but it's worth another 2 minutes. Says the Gemara, asking the question itself, once you tell me that they're both true, they both have a claim on truth, they're both Divrei Elokim Chayim, so how come you get the big Beis Hillel? Across the board, I mean, it's like a domino effect. You know, it's a wipeout. It's a total, you know, it's almost like the game last night. I mean, it's unbelievable. How could it be? What's, you know, why is that fair? So the Gemara tells us something unbelievably important. You know why the halacha is like Beis Hillel? Bimnei shenuchin va'aluvin hayu. They were kind. They were humble. They were courteous. V'shonin divrehen v'divrei Beis Shammai. You know, in the Beis Medrash or Beis Hillel, they didn't just learn their own shitas; they learned the other shitas. And not only that, says the Gemara, not only did they learn the shitas of Beis Shammai, if they were opening up a shir and they wanted to have a discussion, they started off with the Beis Shammai's opinion. You know, which the Gemara is clearly conveying as an additional layer of respect. Right? It's an amazing thing, right? And to be honest, it's probably a musar for all of us. How often do any of us do it, you know, right? How much time is spent, you know, in Gush, you know, truly studying, I don't know, the Hashkaf of the Satmar Hasidim? And it's a reasonable question to ask how much time in the Satmar Yeshivas are spent studying, you know, our Hashkafa, or Merkaz Arab Hashkafa, or Lakewood Hashkafa, or any Hashkafa, right? Most, you know, we've become a very tribalized world, unfortunately, and most communities and yeshivas just reinforce, you know, the reinforcement is necessary. I'm not saying the reinforcement shouldn't be necessary in each community, but we seem to have lost track of this Beis Hillel idea of, you know, genuinely studying and actually giving precedence, at least in our study, to the other shitas. Not because we think they're right. Beis Hillel obviously thought they were right. But nevertheless, Beis Hillel, with great derech eretz and courtesy, studied the other shitos and, in fact, even gave them hearing, not just, you know, a token, a statement. I think that's clearly something the Gemara is trying to convey. Now, why is that a reason to give the psak like them? It's a nice idea. You can give me a chance to editorialize and get on my high horse for a minute. But now that I'm off the horse, unhurt, how does that make any sense? Why is that make the halacha like Beis Hillel? Just because they were nicer? You know, maybe they'd make better husbands or something, you know, better big brothers. Like, why is that a factor in psak? That's also a very intriguing question. One possibility is kind of supernaturally or spiritually, it was a zchus. They were zocha to find the truth because they had better midos. It's a kind of a derech eretz kadma l'Torah. Maybe it's possible that's what the Gemara means. If I'm not mistaken, I think, I don't want to exactly quote him because I don't think I remember it exactly perfectly, but more or less, I believe many years ago, my Rebbe Rav Rosenzweig suggested that even though that is probably a partial truth, he also thought on a more prosaic, down-to-earth level, there was another element to the truth, and that is that even on a purely textual level, if you genuinely and honestly consider, you know, the other opinion, you really think it through, and nevertheless, you still hold on to your own opinion, just from a purely intellectual perspective, it's likely that your opinion will be much stronger and much better grounded. Because it's not like you're going to all of a sudden, oh, I never even thought about that. If you really thought of the other person's opinion, you saw their good arguments, and you were really open to reversing yourself, and in that fact, you still retain your commitment that, you know, you think I'm right. In fact, there's a more likelihood that, in fact, you are right, given that you genuinely took seriously alternate perspective. The truth that comes out of, the result that comes out of a process which really is considering multiple possibilities, I think intuitively, is more likely to have gotten to be a better result. So whichever the Gemara means, or both, the Gemara says that that is why, in fact, despite Elu v'Elu, we paskin like Beis Hillel. However, now we're ready for the main part of the statement, which is the middle part. The one little phrase which served as the title of the shir, which to me philosophically and therefore religiously is really an important topic and one which is very, very vexing, which is what in the world does that mean? Elu v'elu divri Elohim chayim. How could that be? How could that be? Two shitos, again, we're taking quintessential Ba'ali Plukta, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. You say Tameh, I say Tahor. You say Kosher, I say Treif. You say Laila, I say Yom. You know, you could argue for whichever one you want to say, but how could they both be true? They seem to be just contradictory. How is it possible? And obviously, I think this is our goal here, is not just to understand the concept, but it's through the concept, listen carefully, it's through the concept and through answering this specific question that we can not only satisfy that curiosity, but more importantly, more profoundly and far-reachingly, we can understand what the whole aim and method of the halachic process is. But that's not a small thing. But I do believe that, at least on some level, we can answer those very deep and far-reaching and profound questions through an understanding of this phrase. What is Elu v'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim? Okay, everybody with me? So we have a Gemara, a very interesting Gemara. I mentioned a few side points which are worthy of consideration, although not anymore for our purposes tonight. But our purpose tonight, we want to understand, what does Elu v'Elu Divrei Elokim Chayim mean? How can it mean what it seems to say? And what does that tell us about the halachic process? Is it about finding truth? Are these opinions attempting to find truth? Is there one truth? Are there more? What exactly is going on? Yes. Yud Gimel Beis. Now the Gemara in Chagiga on Daf Gimel Amud Beis actually says something very similar, not identical, does not use this phrase, but it's a complementary Gemara. The Gemara here is commenting on a phrase from Koheles, which refers to Torah or the Chachamim as Ba'alei Asufos, those who are, you know, gathering the assemblies. What are these assemblies? So the Gemara tells us these are the Tamid Chachamim that are sitting in these various groups arguing and discussing Torah. Halalu Matamim, Halalu Matarin, Halalu Osirin, Halalu Matirin, Halalu Poslin, Halalu Machshirin. You have all these people arguing. One says kosher, one says posel, one says Tamim, one says Torah. Same idea. They're exactly opposite and contradictory. And that puts the obvious question, which we're probably thinking, into the words of the Gemara. Shema Yomar Adam, Hechani Loma Torah Me'ata. How can I possibly learn? I don't even know. My head is spinning. It's right, left, Tummy, Torah, Kosher, Treif. Which one is it? What's the truth? So the Gemara says, quotes the continuation of the end of that Pasuk in Koheles, Kulam Natnu Miroa Echad. Despite what seems to be an insurmountable burden of self-contradiction, they're all nevertheless coming from the same source. They're all coming from Hashem. Kel echad natnu, parnas echad amron, adon kol ha'maasim baruch hu, v'chsiv, v'edaber Elokim et kol hadvarim e'ela. And the Gemara here darshins, Hashem said all of these things, the Beis Shammais and the Beis Hillels, the Tameh and the Tahor, even all of the contradictions. And the Gemara here actually alludes to uses a metaphor which is based on a pasuk as well. It refers to kind of the different aspects here of, you know, the Torah again, but it addresses here in the Gemara the obvious problem. It seems, just how do you make sense of all this machlokes and these really extreme contradictions? How can you say they're all from Sinai? We're all getting, you know, we're Shavuos is celebrating by Shammai and Beis Hillel. How does that actually make sense? All right. So that's our question. Okay, everyone got the question? So there are a lot of understandings of Elu v'Elu. I'm like, 6, 7, 8, I'm not exactly sure exactly how many there are, but I think that they really all fit, broadly speaking, into two categories. And again, they're not just about explaining Elu v'Elu, as important as that would be. They're actually doing something even more important. They're explaining how the what's the aim or goal of the process of halacha. And to put it in a cute kind of way, but I think see in a minute accurately, I hope, and it'll help you remember this. What I like to say is that the chakira, if you will, the basic approaches, are asking the following question. What is halacha really about? Is it science or is it art? What do I mean by that? When you do a science experiment, you're trying to discover the truth. You know, these two things, do they yield this result? They don't yield this result. So you do various experiments. sometimes you get, you don't get the result you're looking for, so you tinker. You thought if you put in this much of water and this much of whatever the other chemical is and a third amount, you thought you'd get the desired result. You thought it would explode and make your teacher all excited. You know, but it didn't explode. It was a lame experiment. So you realize, well, I guess I need more of the other thing. And oh, then that's too big. So you keep on trying until you get it right. Right, those 5-6 times you tried the experimental method, as we call it, right? It's very good unless you just happen to get lucky or a genius and you could figure it out on the first time. But really, what's the quote-unquote true method? The one that finally yielded the result you wanted. Right? So what about the other ones? They just weren't. Right? One worked. One possible way of looking at halacha is that way as well. There may be lots of shito there. This, you know, sometimes you're lucky it's only a two-way machlokas. But as you know, sometimes it's a much bigger machlokas than just two shitos. And they're all trying to figure out what that proper balance is, what the right shita is. But whenever it is and however it is that we've decided and distilled halach is like him, halach is like them, Beis Hillel, whoever, in essence, one possible way of looking at it is that's the correct one. And the other ones were just good and valiant attempts, you know, they get shkayach, they tried. But like in science, there's one that's right and the other ones just weren't. You know, we tried, we looked, we tested it. Okay? That's one possibility. The alternative possibility is to look at halacha like art. I'm not such an art connoisseur, certainly not in a sophisticated way, although, you know, if I see something that seems to me to be pretty or attractive, you know, I'll notice that, I'll enjoy that for a moment. But obviously, when you have people who are serious art connoisseurs, you know, they can look at a picture, and I don't just mean an abstraction, even, you know, something in a more traditional form of art, and, you know, they can spend time thinking about, you know, what is this conveying? What was the artist trying to say? What is the meaning of this picture? And we know that there can be various different interpretations, multiple truths, as it were. And in the world of art, we don't see it as, you know, only one of them is right, the rest of you are wrong. On the contrary, I think, if I'm not mistaken, we often, one of the ways we kind of can describe or detect a particularly beautiful or particularly profound and expert painting or picture is davka the fact that it has the ability to yield multiple interpretations. That's not looked at as a chisaron, if you will. That's actually looked at as an indication of just how beautiful, how deep, how rich, how sophisticated, you know, the thinking of the artist was and the particular picture or painting is. Right? And that's actually not contradictory at all. There's multiple layers of this truth. And in fact, it's not at all considered contradictory. If anything, it lends its beauty. Question is that halacha? Is halacha more like art with multiple truths? Or is it more like science where there's that one truth that we're all just trying to get? So I think with that as what I believe is a useful and helpful way of organizing our thought, let's see some of the shitos and we'll see which camps they fit in. One of the very, very classic approaches to this question is offered but in the Sefer Nesivos HaMishpat. It's known as the Nesivos, right? You learn Shulchan Aruch, I'm sure this year, Bar Metzia, you certainly got to it, the Ketos and the Nesivos. So the Nesivos is a commentary written by Rav Yaakov Lisa on Chosh HaMishpat, the Chosh HaMishpat section of Shulchan Aruch. And in his introduction, a lot of the topics and sources that we'll quote tonight are from various introductions of great Achronim and others. So in the Nesivos, in his introduction, he is exactly bothered by this question. And he heats his answer and his approach very unequivocally. He says, I'll read you some of the key lines. Va'af gamzos shahashigia v'hata'os sheker hu ba'atzmuso. If I caught that right, if I counted correctly, I think that's three very strong words he used for the incorrect opinion, the non-halacha, the Beis Shammai, if you will. He refers to it as a ta'us, as a shigia, and if those two synonyms for mistake aren't enough, he then refers to it as sheker. I don't think he means that they were trying to lie, but it's just an exaggerated way of saying they're wrong. In their essence, he says. But in the very next breath, he says, mikol makom, however, to'elas yesh b'lachachamim, but they were necessary. They're wrong, but they were necessary. And he gives a very, very powerful and, to me, memorable mashal to describe this. He describes in a world before you had, you know, underwater cameras and underwater lights, he describes the process of deep sea diving or when they used to dive for pearls. Right? You have to go down in the water, go to the ocean floor, find an oyster, bring it up to the top, and, you know, you hope that there's a pearl inside, right? I think that's how it works. Anyway, so you know, nowadays it's probably still a little bit of work, but much easier with technology. In the olden days, what you used to do, you used to go down, you know, feel around, this feels like stir, go up to the top, check, no, go back down again, come back up, no. He says, let's say you imagine the diver goes down 9 times, each time gets a rock, no good, no good, no good. The 10th time he gets the oyster. What do you say about the first 9? Were they useless? Were they a waste of time? Of course not, he says. Without the first 9, he never would have found the 10th. And you could say that in one of 2 ways. Either you could say, midin battleship. Okay, it's not there, it's not there, it's not there. Oh, it's there. Or, since the Nesivus apparently never played battleship, he describes, if I understand correctly, more like refining your sense of touch. Remember, they're in the dark down there. So, you know, this feels like an oyster. Then you come back to the surface and you see that it's a stone. But eventually, enough attempts, now you know the difference between an oyster and a rock. So therefore, says the Nesivus, even though Beis Shammai is wrong, but as a system, we never would have discovered Beis Hillel had it not been for the trial and error process, which included all of the other shitos. That is the famous mashal of the Nesivos. So clearly, using the terminology we mentioned, this is a strong approach, says the Nesivos, for the halacha as science approach. What does elu v'elu divrei Kim Chayim mean according to the Nesivos? Not that they're all true. I didn't say elu v'elu divrei emes. Divrei Elokim Chayim, says the Nesivos, means they're necessary parts of the halachic process. We owe everything to Beis Shammai, because without Beis Shammai we wouldn't have had Beis Hillel. So they're necessary. They contribute. They're vital. But ultimately, says the Nesivos, there is only one truth, and the other ones are just mistakes. But it's not a mistake and a waste of time, you know, in the sense, you know, that if you made a wrong turn, and instead of getting, you know, to the amusement park with your family, you ended up at the cherry picking farm, which no one wants to go to, right? That's not a mistake that's useful. That would be a waste of time. And vice versa, if you prefer picking cherries. The point is, certain mistakes are just a waste of time. Certain mistakes really are useless. But says the Nesivos and halachic process, even though they're mistakes, they're wrong, but they're not useless. On the contrary, they're actually vital and necessary. Yes, Daniel.
So, according to that logic, if we just got to Beis Hillel to start with, we would never meet Beis.
Correct. And the Chanami.
But I assume a lot of times Beis Hillel thought of their opinion before Beis Shammai.
Again, it doesn't always work in the most linear way. You know, there's no guarantee. I don't think he's suggesting that every time Beis Shammai was, you know, like in class, you know, when the teacher asks a question, there's always that one kid who's the first one. You know, I don't think they're saying that Beis Shammai was always the first one to raise their hand, and then all of a sudden Beis Hillel said, that doesn't sound right, but if I tweak it, it's not speaking about something that it was as that simplistic or that linear. But the overall process, again, what we see in the Gemara is the results. You know, we don't know exactly how they were arguing in the Beis Medrash. We see, you know, that which was distilled and edited, whether it's in the Mishnah by Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi or in the Gemara by Rabbi Yehuda, clearly those are redacted and edited discussions. Obviously, those discussions were much more far-ranging than, as big as Shas is, clearly that's only the cliff notes to actual discussion. Much like, you know, if you had notes, you know, even if you took notes of Seder, that wouldn't nearly encompass, assuming you were learning productively for 3 hours, the amount of things that were discussed and back and forth in the Seder. I mean, you could write that down. That's like the congressional record, but then no one would have read it. Right? So you distill it into the highlights. But the overall process of give and take, that's what he's trying to say. You know, if in Shir, you know, we're trying to solve a problem and everyone's arguing about it from different perspectives, and we end up reaching what we think is the truth, and maybe that's more like, you know, Mati's, you know, with his idea, that doesn't mean that what Daniel or, you know, what Ariel or somebody said was completely worthless. It's the process through that cauldron of ideas bouncing off each other, you know, that, yeah, is it possible that, you know, somebody just thought of something and they just nailed it right away? Yeah, of course it's possible. And then, in theory, if you could identify that, then Nesivos would probably say, yeah, Inechanami, in that case, it didn't really do much. But he's not speaking about individual cases, he's speaking about a system. The system required this process in order to yield the truth. Okay? Now, not exactly as clearly or in the same way, but the Netziv also has a similar idea. The Netziv was a prolific author, and one of the things he wrote was a commentary to the Shiltos. The Shiltos is a book which is in Aramaic, which was from Rabbi Chai Gaon, which were drushos he gave on Shabbos. And the Netziv, it was really a closed book for hundreds of years. So the Netziv decided to make it, I never read enough to know why the Netziv picked this, but he picked this as an area of his study, and he wrote a whole commentary on the Sheotos called the Hamek Shela, which has made it a much more accessible and popular work. And his introduction, the actual introduction, a very long introduction, is called the Kidmas Ha'emek. So there, in the Netziv, in his introduction to this work, he also discusses, not Il directly, but the basic idea, and he says, listen, it's true when you have different shitos. One, to use his terminology, is the Ikar, and another one might be the Tetafel. However, he says, just because it's the Tafel, Shema Tomar Shem Kein Hu Adavar Batel, Ve'enu Bechalal Or HaTorah, does that mean that it's completely worthless? That it's not connected to the light of Torah? Says the Netziv, Chas V'Shalom. And here he uses a phrase which is comes up a number of times of Shas. It's a quote from actually the Pasuk in the Navi Yirmiyahu and Parakav Gimel, which refers to Torah as Kipatish, Yifotzei Tzela. Like the hammer breaking the rock into, you know, hundreds of different little pieces. So the halachic process is basically taking what was once an indivisible, unified Torah, and Kipatish Kipote Tzela, it's breaking it up into the thousand different pieces. So halacha now, and the various different shitos, are these little pieces of rock that have flown into a hundred different directions. But, to paraphrase the Gemara we saw earlier, Kula Nikneu Mirecha, they all came originally from a single source. And therefore each one of these opinions, it has some element of that, what he calls Or HaTorah, because it originally came from that same place. He says, nevertheless, even though there's an argument, we do have to paskin, right? We can't be paralyzed. We have to live. We have to know what tefillin to put on. You know, how many hours to wait? Can you have meat and milk? You can't have meat and milk, right? We have to, you know, chicken and milk is allowed, it's not allowed. All the millions of questions you can think of. We do have to decide something. So that's our best effort at finding what he calls the emes lahora, the truth for psak, for practical ramifications. But nevertheless, he says, shar hadeos. Even those other opinions which didn't reach the ultimate truth, nevertheless, lo klum. They're not nothing. On the contrary, they still came out of this sela of machlokes, this rock, this force of machlokes, which shatters the various truths of Torah into different light. They have a certain part of Torah, they have a certain innate conceptual value, even if they don't necessarily have a practical value. Plus, he points out, even if on a practical level, might not be hustling like them now, but there might be an aspect of them which reveals the truth. I'm sure, again, in the various shurim that you were in, or are in now currently in the Gemara, you know, in your shurim in the morning, whether it's your Rebbe or maybe a Reb Chaim or something that you saw throughout the year, so that's very often what happens. You know, Reb Chaim, I think, does this a lot. He has a certain insight, you know, into the Ravid or something like that, and even if in the end he goes with the Rambam, what you end up getting in his insight in the Rambam was just a modified version of the original breakthrough that he got. So that's a perfect example of this phenomenon, that sometimes you can have a shita which we might not paskin like, but by studying that, it actually reveals a deeper conceptual truth, which then in its final application has to be tweaked, and we go like the application of a different shita, Rishon, Achron, Amora, Tana, whatever. But that they're all different, it's like different aspects of the sides of the diamond, they each reflect and refract a different part of the ultimate light, which they were part of. Yes, Monty.
Okay, say that it's like Machlokes, Rava, Abayim, possibly like Rava, but then later on, some circumstance comes up and you want to change it.
Good. So, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. So, if you're asking, or if one would ask, which would be a fair question, when and how can you do that? So, that is a very good and fair question, but not the topic of this year. But to the extent that what you are asking is, how does the fact that it might be possible, does that relate to the ultimate value of the different opinions? That is very much related. We'll get back to that when we see a Rashi. There's an important Rashi, which we're going to see in a few minutes, that very much touches on what you just said. Okay, those are two approaches. I want to mention one more, which I think is also in this science approach, where there's one more ultimate truth, but then there's value, instrumental value in the other opinions. And then we'll move to a completely different way of looking at it. And that is a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Again, not a tshuva, I should say, I'm sorry, but Rav Moshe is again his hakdama, his introduction to the Igros Moshe. And here Rav Moshe Feinstein has what I would call a very super minimalist approach to Elu V'Elu, Divrei Elokim Chayim. What do I mean by that? Says R' Moshe. He says very simple. He says, when we say Divrei Elokim Chayim, he says, Haim Divrei Torah Mamish. For emphasis. He says, what we mean is they are part of the corpus of Torah, or as we would say, the Cheftza of Torah. Beis Shammai, even though we don't paskin like them, is part of the Cheftza of Torah. Abaye, even though we don't paskin like him, as part of the cheft of Torah. Well, what does that mean? That's just, you know, spinning nice fancy words. So lemay nafkimina, what's the bottom line, says Moshe? Very simple. Let's say you wake up early in the morning and you want to daven, you want to learn before you've davened. And it happens to be the thing that you're learning now, you open up 10 straight lines of Beis Shammai's opinion. Says Moshe, you have to make a Berachas HaTorah first. You're not allowed to learn or Chaim Sin Mem Zayin. You can't learn. It's not just a mitzvah to make the Torah, it's an isser to learn before you've made the brachos of Torah each morning. So you might have thought, Beis Shammai is Shloa Libadilcha. We don't pass him like Beis Shammai. So maybe that's not really part of Torah. Maybe I could just learn it without the bracha. It's just interesting. It's stimulating. Says R' Moshe, no. Elu ve'elu means Haim Divrei Torah Mamish. They're part of the corpus. They're a cheftza of Torah. And therefore, if you learn them, you have to make a Berachas HaTorah on them, and your Yotzei, your mitzvah of Limud HaTorah, even that way. Rav Shechter, I've heard him say it in a very similar way, also takes this kind of a minimalist approach, and Rav Shechter says, you shouldn't think that if you open up a Gemara and you spend an hour on Beis Shammai's opinion, that's not an hour of Bittul Torah. No, because that's the same idea as Rav Moshe, that's part of the corpus, it's part of the Bittul Torah. Just like as a Moshal, he said, let's say you're learning Erevin, or you're learning a particular sugya, you're learning Megillah or something, right? Everything you're learning is about a mitzvah derabanan. Does that mean that on a Daraisa level you're doing Bittul Torah? Because on the Daraisa level what you're learning about doesn't exist? So it's just, no, that's absurd. The derabanans, it basically become integrated into the system and become part of the Cheftza of Torah. So if it's, I'm not sure which one would be a bigger Kal Vachomer, I'm not sure, but in a parallel way, the Daraisas, even if they're quote-unquote wrong, Alohli B'dihokhasa, the Beis Shammai's, the Abayis, whoever of the world, nevertheless, they are part of the Cheftza of Torah, and therefore they have value in studying them. There's a mitzvah in Talmud Torah studying them. But are they true? No, there's one truth, that's the Beis Hillel. So here also, again, all three of the things that we saw until now, the Nesivos, the Netziv and Rav Moshe / Rav Shechter, none of them said the exact same thing. But I think the common denominator of all of them is that halacha is more like science. There is a truth. As best as we can as human beings, we're trying to find the truth. Lo b'shemayim, Hashem gives us the authority and the right to do that. So maybe we won't get it. Okay, maybe one day Hashem will tell us we got it wrong. We'll worry about that then. But the way we live, Hashem, this is the process that Hashem designed, is for us, using certain rules and methods, is to find the truth as best we can. If that's the case, what about all the other quote-unquote mistakes along the way? And Hanami, they're mistakes, but they have value. They have value instrumentally, because like the rock and the pearl and the oyster, it helps us find the truth. They have value because they are like shades of the aspects of the diamond. They reflect and refract aspects of truth, even if they don't hit the bullseye directly head on, or just because of reasons, the most way we could, minimalist way we could say, they may not necessarily enhance the process or not, but learning them, studying them, has a certain value. Okay? All of this, I think, shares of that more minimalist approach. Maybe it's the right one, who am I to say, but more of a minimalist approach to the term Elu Elu, and therefore understanding the process, again, is the way I like to think of it, more like science. Yes?
You said it might be like a better reading of Elu Elu than it would be really good time, because it's saying about anything
right. And a Hanami. That's clearly what they're working off of. Yes, absolutely. Okay? Now, to the extent that there are Rishonim who spoke about this topic, the Rishonim see something different. There's a Rashi and a Ritva, which both seem to look at something in a very different way. The Rashi is in Masechet Ksubos. This is what I was alluding to before when Nati asked this question. Daf Nun Zayin Amud Aleph. Says Rashi, it depends on what machlokas you're talking about. Let's say, for example, there were, you know, for some reason which I can't possibly fathom, not everyone is at the shir now. But let's say afterwards you're at dinner and someone says, oh, you were at Rabbi Gottlieb's shir, to which you respond, of course. And then they said, well, what did he say? Oh, yeah, you know, it looked like an interesting topic. What did he say? And let's say one of you says, well, he said, X, Y, Z. And then the other one says, no, you weren't paying attention, you missed it. He was said X, Y, and PQ. So says Rashi, we have those kind of machlokas all the time in Shas. Right? Two Talmidim are arguing about what the Rebbe said, what the Masorah is of X or Y. Says Rashi, about that kind of a machlokas, everyone means well, they're all trying to do their best. But nevertheless, says Rashi, Chad minayhu mashaker. Now, he doesn't mean lie like deliberately. But again, it's a very strong way of saying, clearly one of them is wrong. Clearly one of them was really paying attention to Shir, and one of them was, half paying attention to Shir, spacing out, looking at his screen, playing with his toys, doing whatever else he was doing, right? You think you can multitask, you really can't, and you're not going to get all the Shir if you're distracted about other things. Someone who's just concentrating on the Shir is going to get everything. So one is right and one is wrong. That, says Rashi, that's clear. But, says Rashi, there are so many other different machlokuses in Shas, which are not like that at all. Rather, he says, there are other times where you have ki pligi tram orai bedin, or beisra beheter. It's not the arguing, what did my Rebbe say? What did we hear in the yeshiva? They're arguing, each on their own 2 feet, what do we think the din should be? Is it mutter? Is it usr? Tamei or tor? Kachad omer? Hachi mistaber taima? Each one says, I think this makes more sense. I think this makes more sense. Then says, in that case, says Rashi, ein kan sheker. Then there's no one who's wrong. What does it mean there's no one who's wrong? Each one's telling you the best that they think. And about such a machlokes, elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. Now, what does he mean by that? Zimnin deshaya chay taima, v'zimnin deshaya chay taima. There may be times in history where it appears more like this shita, but then there might be other times in history where it appears more like the other shita. Shehatam mitapech. What seems more convincing, what seems more plausible or likely, can change based on even minor changes in circumstances or other factors. And therefore, says Rashi, it's important that for the record, the halachic record, of note, all the different shitos are preserved because they're all doing their best. They're all not only part of the halakhic process in the way that Netziv said it, but in fact, not only are they conceptually adding perspectives that are valuable, they may actually even be a practical truth. Maybe now one Bezdin thought it, but maybe another Bezdin will think the other one is. But the differences between, it's not black and white, we're not right and wrong, good and bad, as he put it, it's shinoi muat. We have to decide as best we can in every generation which shita we think is right. But it's not a huge difference. On the contrary, it's me looking at the picture and seeing one way, and you looking at seeing at a different shade. Before I take any questions, let me just tell you what the Ritva says. The Ritva, which is perhaps the single most famous approach to this whole idea, the Ritva is an Erevin on the Gemara we started with, and the Ritva quotes the Chachmei Tzarfas, which in Spanish or Shonim referred to, Tosfos. Chachmei Tzarfas, the rabbis from France. So is the Ritva. I heard a pshat from the Tosfosin. And he asked the question again. He asked the question better than I could. Heich efsher shu shneim divrei Elokim chayim. How could it be? Zoser v'zematir. And again, unlike what you said, the Rashi, the Tosfos and the Ritva don't like this cute little, they didn't say true in MS, they said divrei Elokim chayim. Tosfos says, no. Hashem said that how could they both be part of Hashem? Right, Tosfos in the question does not see that as a big deal. They think that's all basically the same thing. But it's a contradiction. How could it be? Tier 2, what do the Tosfos say? This is Mamash Ashur Torah. Kishalu Moshe Lamorom. Makabal HaTorah. When Moshe went up on that mountain to Makabal the Torah. Heru lo al kol davar v'davar. Mem tes ponim li'isur. Umem tes ponim l'hatir. This is the origin of the ultimate multiple truth theory. Says Tosfos, in fact, they're all from Hashem in the sense that quite literally, on every possible question, again, I don't think the number 49 is necessarily meant to be literal. It means an exhaustive possibility. Not only did Moshe get taught in every halacha a way in which the answer would be Tameh and Tahor, Moshe got taught the exhaustive possible rationales and arguments for why it might be Tahor. And then, exact opposite way, Hashem showed Moshe an exhaustive different reasons and aspects and dimensions of why it might be just the opposite. On every question, you might have wondered at some point in your life, if Moshe didn't eat, drink, or sleep, what did he actually do for 40 days? That's a lot of learning. The answer is, well, if it's not just learning Taryag Mitzvos, but learning on every single mitzvah, the reasons for Tameh and Tar, Asr and Mutter, and every possible argument for Tameh, every possible argument for Asr, on every single issue, Well, that could take a while, even if you're a masmid. That, says the Ritva, it's always given to Moshe on Sinai. So then you'll say, well, if that's true, then that's like paralyzing. I mean, then what do I? How do I know what to do? So says the Tosfos, that was Moshe's question. Moshe said, Shala Kodesh Baruch was that. Moshe asked Hashem, V'omer, Shiazem Masrur L'Chachma Yisrael. What am I supposed to do with all this? If you just told me the truth, so I'll tell the Am Yisrael the truth. And then maybe you'll give me some historical explanation for where Machlokas came from, or, but says, if now you're telling me that no, all the Machlokas was already up in Shemayim, and you gave it all to Moshe, so how, Moshe says, how am I supposed to know what to do? Do I tell them to wait 6 hours, or not to wait 6 hours? I can eat chicken and meat and milk, they can't eat chicken and milk. What are they supposed to do? Dover Shlom Eskavin is Mutter, Dover Shlom Eskavin is Osir. You know, Psik Reshet Lo Nichalei is Mutter, it's Osir. Those are tips for the Shabbos guys. Right? But how am I supposed to know what to do? So says the Ritva continuation. That's what Hashem said to him. Zem Masru L'Chachma Yisrael. Shebechol Dor V'Dor V'Yachra'a Kamosa. Says the Ritva in conclusion from Tosfos, that's exactly what the process of Psak is. Yod Gimel Mido Shatar and Jeshurban. Acher Rabban Lahatos. There are rules to the system. The system isn't just a random amount of information. There are rules in the system for how to weigh evidence. Right? You saw a lot of that in Bava Metzia. You know, you have two people arguing over a thing. So what's more important is, you know, do you go by Chazaka? Do you go by Taina? Is it Shura Dadaini? Is it this? Is it that? All the different ways to be Macharia, right? So you have an argument for Torah, you have an argument for Torah. Must be Macharia of Araya. Does that beat a Chazaka? Does that beat a Rove? Does it beat... There are rules to the system. The Chachamim have to learn not only the information, but the rules of the game, like anybody would, Lahavdil, if it would be a different kind of a sport or game. And then, in each generation, they'll have to figure out what they think is right. But let's say they paskin like, again, Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel, right? You count, you light one candle, then two candles, then eight candles. So, well, does that mean, you know, again, that's Darabonon, but leave aside how we understand the status of Darabonon. Let's pick Daraisa, where the same phenomenon occurred. Right? How many walls should the sukkah be? How high does the sukkah have to be? What material does it have to be? How many minim are there? Whatever. What's kosher for an esrog? What's not kosher for an esrog? You can use a stolen esrog on the first day. You can't use a stolen esrog on the first day. So the ma'isa, we have a psak for all these things. But what about the shita that we don't hold like? What's the status of that? So kosher that comes out according to the ritva. It is just even the shitas that we don't paskin like have just as much a claim to divine origin and to ultimate truth as the shittas that we do paskalite. In this world, with the human kalim and the rules that Hashem gave us, we have to figure out which one we think makes the most sense to do our best to come to a hachra'a, and Allah Rashi, maybe in a different generation, rabbis will reverse their opinion. It's possible. Rules how to do that. Not our shir now. But in theory, it's possible if you follow the rules. But nevertheless, we're all basically picking between truth and truth. Between what was given to Moshe and what was given to Moshe. It's all part of the same system. None of them were... It's not like my shita was the one Hashem told and yours, you just got it wrong somehow in the game of telephone. They're all from there. That's, again, as I say, that kind of multiple truth theory. Now again, this, to use the metaphor I started with, is much more obviously akin to art. This is nothing like science, right? Right? You wouldn't say, you know, the experiment that worked and the experiment that didn't work were equally both true. It was just I like the one that, you know, blew up in front of my teacher and not the lame one, right? That would be ridiculous in science. It doesn't make any sense. In art, however, you could say, you know, the artist had actually both of these ideas in mind, right? That's the beauty of art, right? If the ultimate artist, with a capital A, drew this beautiful moral landscape that we call the Torah, it's certainly conceivable that he encoded and embedded in it an infinite number of possibilities. And whatever system we use to try to practically not be paralyzed and reach conclusions that let us live a Torah, a life that we believe is in consonance with his moral will, that doesn't mean that that the other ones that we're not doing weren't embedded equally at the same time in Har Sinai into the process. Again, if you're philosophically inclined, you might find it easy to understand or even attractive. If you're not philosophically inclined, you might find it curious or not persuasive. That's also fine because we have the whole other approach. But that is the approach you see from Rashi and the Ritva. Yes?
Not machlokes that aren't just eight candles to one or one to eight or how many walls it is, but it's like a way you view the world. For instance, are the Jews
in Hashkafa.
The purpose of the world?
Okay, fine. So I'm not sure. They're not addressing Hashkafa. I'm not sure, but I can't necessarily deduce because it's clear they're talking about halakha.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm not sure. That would be, have to be a separate discussion. Yes?
Well, like, there are also going to be times where there's something isn't here and it's wrong.
Like?
Like, somebody says, oh, it is kosher.
So yeah, there, I'll tell you what, so that, I'll tell you, can I explain to you? Because there you're not, you can't go, there are rules to the system. Right? One of the needlessly unspoken rules is you can't contradict explicit rules. There's simanim for a kosher meat. Right? You can't say something is kosher if it doesn't have those two simanim. So again, there are not only a huge number of facts that are given over, there are also rules of interpretation. The only possible you can make a truth claim if you're consistent with the facts and you follow the rules.
Then again, I mean, that was an exaggeration, of course, but you could, whenever you have two opinions, Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel, Beis Hillel thinks Beis Shammai is wrong because it contradicts something else, as in because we say, oh, we don't relate this to halacha, and therefore...
Correct, and on that says the Ritva, and again, without the example of Moshe up in Shemayim, that vivid image, I think Rashi more or less is saying the same thing. All those different possibilities were given to Moshe. They're all parts of an ultimate truth.
Like, according to Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai isn't a possibility because it's inherently wrong, because it contradicts something else. As in, what's the difference?
So, you're putting those words in Beis Shammai or Beis Hillel's mouth. Right? They didn't say that. They believe that they're right, and obviously, if they believe that they're right, they believe that they're more right than the other opinion.
Because there's something else that comes.
Because they think that they're making a mistake in Echanami.
Which means that they hold it. But if you hold it.
Again, but we're not asking what Beis Shammai holds, we're asking what Hashem holds.
The thing is, where do you draw the line between?
Oh, good. So that's I'm not gonna be able to give you an exhaustive answer to that question because that is incredibly complicated. You know, this idea of halachic pluralism, you know, you could stretch it very far, right? I understand where the wheels in your mind are going, Reb Daniel, and I'll try to at the end give a little like four rules for moving forward based on this. But one of them relates to your question, but we haven't gotten to any practical ramifications yet. Okay. Okay. Now I just want to mention briefly two achronim, who each in their own way seem to go with this kind of approach. One is the Yamshel Shlomo Luria, who wrote a commentary on a few Masechtas that we have, including Baba Kama. In his introduction to Baba Kama, he talks about this, as well as the Maharal and his famous Sefer, the Be'er Hagola. So the Yamshel Shlomo, in his introduction to Baba Kama, also very apropos, he gives you a mystical or metaphysical understanding of what happened at Har Sinai, not Moshe on the mountain, but us at the bottom of the mountain, at the foot of the mountain. Says the Yamshel Shlomo, using Kabbalistic terminology, when the word of Hashem came down, you know, from Sinai, whether it was via Moshe or by Hashem directly, that's a separate issue, but when we got the Torah, at the various stages that it was revealed, the Divine Truth was revealed, it was way too awesome and way too infinite to just be given in kind of a straight way. So he uses the term tsinoros, which are kind of like pipes, which is a Kabbalistic term for how the divine flow comes down to the world. It goes through tsinoros. Again, it's just it's a metaphor. It's a way, it's a terminology used to describe the process of taking something infinite and being the word and will of God and, you know, constricting that into human terminology and categories, right? So that's the process of the tsinoros. But says the Yamshel Shlomo, there were 49 different tsinoros. In other words, the word of Hashem is so vast and so complex and so infinite, it can't be contained in just one understanding. It came down in these 49 different tsinoros. Now, what does that mean, 49 different tsinoros? Not that I really understand that, but he takes it one step further in a way that we can at least more prosaically understand. He says, each person who was at the Mount of Sinai, who heard the word of Hashem, this revelation throughout the time in the Midbar, understood it in the most faithful and sincere way, not because they were paying attention and not paying attention, not because they were texting and not because they were checking their email, not because they were distracted. Each one with sincerity, no one was lying, no one was trying to be mischievous, no one was distracted, but nevertheless, because people are different, they heard and interpreted with slight nuances the same words of Hashem, directly or through Moshe, and reached slightly different conclusions. And therefore, that's what gives yield to quote-unquote machlokes, and that's what gives yield to this idea of elu ve'elu. Namely, yes, Hashem said one thing, but that one thing could not be contained and understood in every dimension by any single person. And therefore, each person only understood an aspect or a dimension of it, and with great integrity and with their best efforts, gave over what they understood. But again, lahavdil, or as a mashal, right? When you have somebody, you know, a great guttle, right? You know, this is a classic phenomenon from Soloveitchik, right? He was so awesome, so overarching, so overpowering, so overwhelming, that even though he had a lot of students, many of them were great in their own right, but it has been noted, and I think the students are the first to admit it, that, you know, none of the students could fully master and encompass every aspect of Soloveitchik's godliness. So each one, and the more talented ones did more, and the less talented did less. But even among the most talented students, they took what they could. And if you ask them to describe and tell over their Rebbe, each one with the most sincerity and integrity, you're going to get a slightly different picture than somebody else, because they themselves are limited, and therefore they could only get what they could get. So if that was true with Talmidim of Baron Cutler, or Talmidim of Soloveitchik, or whoever, and we do see this on the human level all the time, so Allah has come and come, says Yom Shor Shlomo, that's what was happening up in Har Sinai. The Maharal, without any of that stuff, he speaks in typical more Maharalian philosophical and metaphysics. Maharal just says very simply, there's no such thing as absolute truth. This is the closest thing you can get to something being relative, because even he limits it to halachic categories. But within the world of halacha, there are still sidelines. There's such a thing, for the Maharal, there are things that are out of bounds. Playing field Maharal, everything is made up is murkab. That's a classic Maharalian word. Everything is murkab. It's all compound. It compounds. It's made up. So this thing we call kosher, not because there's no tit, he says, but because it's primarily kosher. So it's 99% kosher, but it doesn't mean it doesn't have any aspect of tumah. And this other thing we call tameh or treif, not because it has no truth or no tahara in it, but it was primarily the other thing. But everything, says the Maharal, is a compound, is a combination of factors, some in greater proportion, some in lesser proportion. And therefore, even the shita that we don't hold like is just a different point along the same spectrum, but it has all the same ingredients of truth that the opinion we do paskin like has. It's just in a slightly different proportion, which again, as best as we can as human beings, we feel that that's the one that comes closer to the truth. But the very elements that are attracting us to the opinion that we hold are true exist just in a different formulation or in a different order in the opinion that we didn't hold like. So there's aspects, to the extent that we think we found the truth, so it's the opinion that we paskin like, but the other opinions have the very same ingredients, just maybe either lesser or kind of, you know, it's like, you know, you shake up a thing and it comes out a little differently, but it's all the same ingredients. I just have a few more minutes, so let me just wrap up with the practical, like where we go from here, what do we keep in mind from this, and then as I walk you guys to dinner, I'll be happy to answer any other questions. But I just want to finish the actual shiur in another few minutes. So, Lamaisa, what have we seen? Again, you can sum up the whole shiur in 1 minute. That is to say, we have a concept called Elu Ve'elu. It seems to be intriguing, but almost inexplicable at first glance. And basically, if you summarize all the different shitas we saw, I think broadly speaking, we see two different approaches. Again, there were nuances, but basically two different approaches. One approach says there's an ultimate single truth, and the value of the other shitos are that they help us find the truth, or they're diluted versions of the truth, or maybe we'll change our mind about the truth, but really, 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 there's only one truth. And again, I'm, for shorthand, calling that the scientific approach. Halacha is science. The other approach says no, on some level, as best as we can humanly understand this, because it's something that's beyond our comprehension ultimately, there's a multiple truth. Not in the relative sense that we don't really believe anything so we can believe everything, which is kind of like postmodern man, but rather, it's all ultimately and absolutely true. Now that can't be true on a human level, but it's true on a divine level. So because Hashem can encompass everything, he can encompass even opposites. And whether you want to take that historical version of the Ritva, that Moshe really was given all these possibilities, or Rashi doesn't say that, so there's no reason to think that Rashi believed that, but you end up in the same place. That they're all reflections and refractions of, in fact, a truth that was ultimately sourced in Hashem. Not a mistaken understanding, not a valiant effort, but in fact, something that really does emanate from Hashem, which may or may not be what we paskin like, but has a claim on being divine, which is the ultimate authority or truth. So that's what I call, as I say, more of the halacha as art approach to the halachic process. So what does this leave us? You know, I hope more enlightened and interested and educated, but what do we do with all this? So very briefly, I wish I had time to do this inside with you, very briefly, four things. The first, which Daniel was asking about, which is the most sensitive issue, which I can't fully do justice to, but I will mention, Rav Moshe and his Hakdama, I don't know if he could have appreciated some of the challenges we have now to halachic integrity, but there were, in every generation, including in Rav Moshe's time, there were issues. You know, his day, and certainly earlier in the 20th century, it was more emanating from the conservative movement, Now we have more complicated questions from within, or people who want to identify as Orthodox. But in those days, it was really from the conservative movement. No, the conservative movement that you and I see now, it doesn't even is a pale and shep. It doesn't even come close to looking like what the conservative movement used to look like. It used to be a much, much more serious and halachic movement. It is way, way gone away from that, unfortunately. But even then, there's a reason that Orthodoxy rejected it. So Rav Moshe, without using the word conservative at all, but Rav Moshe is then discussing, well, if he has Elu, so who's to say, you know, he's a rabbi, how would you distinguish? So Rav Moshe, very, very briefly, without getting into details, he alludes to the fact that just because we see Elu Elu, even if you want to take the most wide-ranging approach, that doesn't mean that everything is kosher. Or, to put it in my words, if we say in Parshanut, Shivim Panim LaTorah, it's Shivim, not Shivim Be'achad. I mean, there is a limit. Just because there can be different ways of looking at something doesn't mean that there are endless ways of looking at something. Now, that still begs the question, well, how do you know where to draw the sidelines? You know, is the field 100 yards or is it 110 yards? You know, so that, again, so Rav Moshe alludes to this. He talks about how, in order for a psak to be legitimate doesn't mean right, in Rav Moshe's view, but at least legitimate. So he speaks about how the person who gives the psak has to be a master of Torah. A prerequisite, they have to be an expert. Now, getting into the historical issues, this was the big part, even in the first generation, of the argument with the conservative movement. And unfortunately, to my great pain and consternation, this is some of the issues that are now re-emerging within the Orthodox community of what is a proper halachic method and proper halachic psak. But nevertheless, those ingredients, mastery, humility, and Yirat Shamayim, and then equally importantly, using the rules of halacha in the way they've been traditionally understood, that at least gives you a claim to Elu Elu. We'll still have to figure out if we possibly like you, but if you have all those things, that's a legitimate shita. Right? So I come from Baltimore, and Rabbi Heinemann, who's a big, big posek and a big person from Baltimore, so he has certain shitas. He's the head of the Star K. He has certain shitas, in certain cases, quite big leniencies about certain things, which the other hashkacha agencies and the other poskim don't hold like. But no one would say that Rabbi Heinemann isn't an expert, doesn't have Yerusha Mayim, doesn't know the rules of the system of halacha. It's an opinion of it. Whether the OU is going to follow them, whether the Rabbanut is going to follow them, is a different question. But he, you know, so that's just as a simple example that you have to have those ingredients in order to at least make a claim on legitimacy. Number two is that sometimes we get cynical or frustrated by all the machlokes, the different opinions. The Aruch HaShulchan, his Hakdama, which is the Hakdama to Chosh Mishpat, Aruch HaShulchan says that's a tragedy. On the contrary, he says, the beauty of halacha is in the machlokes. And he compares, he says, the Torah in Hazinu and in Medrash is compared to a shir. And he uses that as like a symphony. He says, just like in a symphony, the beauty is the variety. If there was, you know, a 20-piece orchestra and they were all, you know, big violins, that would be boring. That would just be a loud violin. But the beauty is arranging it with all the different types of instruments playing in concert. He says, the same thing, the beauty of Torah. And that is that the various different shitos, you shouldn't think, ah, the whole world would just be, you know, that tilumi, wouldn't it be great? On the contrary, it would be so much more boring and vanilla. Nor should you think, if the whole world was just be Hasidish, wouldn't that be great? No, it would just be more boring. And that is beautiful, says the Aruch HaShulchan. The beauty of the Jewish community, the beauty of the halachic system, is that we have, in this multiplicity, now again, that doesn't mean that there can't be somebody who doesn't belong, who runs up on stage and says, I want to play too. Right? That gets back to my first point, opinion, right? 70 opinions, not 71. But again, if you're legitimate, if you fit the criteria we've previously mentioned, so on the contrary, whether we passing like you or not, the variety, in fact, adds to the beauty. And instead of sometimes being frustrated or cynical because of it, we should actually be appreciative of the beauty, and that shows how sophisticated and rich and deep Torah is, that it can yield so many different aspects. Two things before we finish. The Gemara in Ervin, Davav, says something very striking. And again, also used by Shama Beisol, so it's easy to remember. Says the Gemara Ervin, if you go like all of the kulas of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, you're a Rasha. And if you go like all of the chumras of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, you're a fool. That's the Gemara talking, not me. Two strong terms. And they're both, I think, the first one is more obvious, but the second one is therefore at least as important. Right? And that is to say, why am I mentioning this now? Because you might think, and plenty of people do, well, there's so many different shitos, it's a smorgasbord, and I can pick whatever I want. So tonight I'm interested in the carving station. I want meat for dinner, and tomorrow I'm going to have the fish for dinner. And you know, at breakfast you go to a hotel. You know, you want pancakes, eggs, or waffles. I'll take all three. Or, you know, I'll tell you, I can do whatever I want. You know, there's all these shitas out there. So you know, should I keep one there, 2 days ago? As long as there's somebody out there who says it's lenient, I'll go like that one. And you know, should I do this? Should I do that? So that, the Gemara says, is rishus. That's a very strong term. Because why is that rishus? Why does the Gemara call that rishus? Because that attitude bespeaks a complete lack of integrity. Everybody knows that that every shiloh you ever ask, the answer is going to be makil. We all understand that would be absurd. So if you are clearly looking, right, you're drawing the target before you shoot the arrow, after you shoot the arrow, excuse me, wherever you hit, you draw the target. Ooh, bullseye! Right, that's clearly a joke. But the opposite is also true, says the Gemara. It's also clear to anyone who learns halacha that that system also sometimes yields leniencies, kulas. And if you're a person who only follows the chumras, you know, just tell me whichever sheet is more machmir, so that's also foolish. Because as Rav Rosenzweig explained it, you're showing a lack of integrity, a lack of belief, excuse me, a lack of trust in the halachic process. Now, which sheet does you hold like? Which kulas you hold like? That's a different question. But to take the extreme example of all makel or all machmir, the Gemara condemns both. The common denominator is a lack of trust in the process and a lack of integrity. That's where something like having a Rebbe comes in, right? If you have your Rebbe, your Rav, so if they're Mekel, you have a right to be Mekel, that's your Rebbe. But just because you heard that in the shul 3 miles away, their rabbi says something, again, you just, you know, you're rabbi hopping, or you think that it's all one big smorgasbord, clearly that's showing the lack of integrity. So Elu V'Elu, my third point is not a license to treat halacha as a joke. And last but not least, I think the greatest thing we can learn from Elu V'Elu is that therefore we should have appreciation for our fellow Jews. This serves as intellectual basis of Achdus. Usually when we hear people speaking about Achdus and Avas Yisrael, it's just kind of this fuzzy feel-good thing. Such a problem with it. The reason we have such a problem with it, a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons is because in our heart of hearts we really, really care. We're passionate. And we really think that they're all wrong. It makes it hard to be respectful of them. It's not a little thing. It's something that we think is vitally important. And they're horribly wrong. Right? And they're worthless. And they're so Elu V'Elu, especially if you take the more art approach, gives the intellectual background and the undergirds the way of having respect for other people. I may believe that this is a better truth for me. My Rabbanim, my Mesorah, my Gedolim, they're that aspect of Hashem. They're one of those 49 ways. But I can understand that where this other person's coming from. Again, if it's a legitimate Shita, even if I think it's the wrong Shita, but that's part of Elu V'Elu. And with this, I'll conclude, is the very beautiful, famous Gemara in Yevamos. Where the Gemara says, using again, Beit Shammai Beit Hillel, there the Gemara talks about how they had major arguments, in particular, about yuchsin, about certain people, are they allowed, this boy left me, that girl left me, that boy. Those are very serious, my focus, but it's a lot more serious than just Chanukah. And nevertheless, says the Gemara, lo yimna Beit Shammai Melisa Nashim Beit Hillel, lo Beit Hillel Beit Shammai. Even having such arguments and such vital things, did not stop them from being close and even marrying with each other. Now, Beit Shammai didn't marry a girl from Beit Hillel that they thought was Osir. But the point is, there was enough mutual respect that if someone said, I have a shidduch for you, Beit Shammai, it's this great girl from Beit Hillel. They trusted them, and there was enough respect that no one would have proposed a shidduch to Beit Shammai from a girl that they knew Beit Hillel that Beit Shammai didn't think would work. And Beit Hillel respected Beit Shammai enough, Beit Shammai respected Beit Hillel enough, that they can live together, be friends, and even marry with each other's families, even if they had disagreements. Because there was enough mutual respect. Now, I don't need to tell you that our fallen world that we currently inhabit, in many ways, is very far from that. But we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to look back to Chazal and the Rishonim, how they understood these concepts and how they lived their own lives, for us to have a model of genuine Talmud Torah, genuine passion, genuine believing in what we believe in, and at the same time, genuine respect for other legitimate Mesorahs within the Jewish people. So I think if you keep all this in mind, I think Har Sinai, Mamad Har Sinai, Kabbalah Torah, and hopefully Shavuos will be that much more meaningful for you for now and hopefully into the future.